dry out for it as we go through this. Psalm number 87. Let's read it together. It is called in the inscription a psalm or a song for the sons of Korah. And the psalm begins like this. His foundation is in the holy mountains. The Lord loveth the gates of Zion more than all the dwellings of Jacob. Glorious things of thee are spoken. Now that's the hymn title. Glorious things are spoken of thee, O city of God. I will make mention of Rahab and Babylon to them that know me. Behold, Philistia and Tyre with Ethiopia. This man was born there. And of Zion it shall be said, this and that man were born in her, and the highest himself shall establish her. The Lord shall count when he writeth up the people that this man was born there. Selah. The singers as well as the players on instruments shall be there. All my springs are in thee. Notice from the inscription, it is once again a song, whichever way you would like it. And what was our observation that when we see a song, psalm, or a psalm, song, what generally does that indicate? What's been the pattern? Not everybody at once. A lot of the Psalms of David, is David an individual crying out for help, for deliverance? In these that are titled as a song or a psalm, when those two words are put together, usually what you see, it is more of a congregational song. It is not an individual sort of a ballad where you're telling your story and you're crying out for help as an individual. It is the song of the people, of the congregation of Israel, and that certainly is going to be the case once again tonight. It is also said to be for the sons of Korah, and remember, Korah was the fellow who rebelled against Moses back there in the Exodus. It is doubtful that these sons of Korah are the ones that lived back then, or even the ones living in David's day. There is a mention here, you'll notice as we read the psalm, of Babylon. And this would most likely then place this psalm written sometime after Babylon has become the great power on the scene. And so most people guess that it was probably written maybe in Hezekiah's day. And the sons of Korah were a particular group of Levites who were still ministering at the temple, especially in music. That seems to be their particular gift. So it's yet another one of these songs, psalm songs, to be sung by the people and dedicated, or to be sung especially by the sons of Korah. Well, let's see what it says. It is a celebration of Zion. And Zion is a nickname for Jerusalem. Notice, first of all, that there is the idea of an anthem. That this we have a national anthem that we sing in honor of our nation. The Canadians sing, Oh Canada. If we had had Sue here tonight, we were going to sing Glorious Things of Thee Are Spoken. Anybody know whose national anthem that is? The tune that we sing that to? Glorious Things of Thee Are Spoken. That is Austria's national anthem. We are familiar with some of these national anthems, and they take great pride in their anthems. Well, this is an anthem. This is sort of like a national anthem, except it's not really dedicated to a nation. It's dedicated to a city. I was trying to think of what songs do we have out there that speak and sing of the glory and the wonder of a city. New York, New York. Maybe it was Memphis. I don't know. You know, do you realize that I saw this in a poll one time, of all the country songs, that Memphis is mentioned more times in country music than any other city? Isn't that interesting? You just think of the number of songs that have come out, you know, singing about Memphis. Obviously, the perception of Memphis is quite a bit better than the reality of Memphis, I think. I'm not sure I'd want to write a song in the honor of Memphis. Can you think of any other songs out there that honor cities? Can you? Well, if you're going to San Francisco, wear some flowers in your hair. Is that what you're? I left my heart in San Francisco. You can see Daryl and I grew up on different sides of the thing there. Yeah. St. Louis? What? Meet me in St. Louis. Chicago. Yeah. We have songs that extol the virtues of certain places, certain cities. This is exactly that. It is a psalm extolling the glory of Jerusalem or Zion. But we need to remember that earthly Jerusalem was more than just an earthly city. It was a typical city. It is representative of a city, the New Jerusalem, a Jerusalem above. Remember the contrast that we saw back in our study on the book of Galatians, where Paul is talking about Abraham and his two wives, Sarah and Hagar, and one represents the earthly Jerusalem, Hagar, who's in bondage with her children. Sarah, which is above, he says, is the mother of us all, the free woman who has given birth to us. So notice we have two Jerusalems, one down here and one up there. There's two mountains, the earthly Jerusalem built on the Mount Zion down here on earth. We've seen in the book of Hebrews, haven't we, there in chapter 12, that we're not come to that earthly mountain, we're come to the heavenly one, to the heavenly Jerusalem, the city of God in the heavens. So remember that as we go through this, and you may say, well, what in the world would a psalm that extols the glory of Jerusalem, what in the world would that mean to me? How would I identify with that? But remember that as we go through this, that this is speaking obviously of the earthly city, but it's also speaking for us of the heavenly Jerusalem above. And we can see the application as we go. Well, if we ask ourselves, what was so unique about Zion or Jerusalem that you would want to write a song about it and glorify the city of Jerusalem? Well, notice as we begin the psalm, we are first of all confronted with the uniqueness of its founding, of its situation. You'll notice first of all that God is the one who has founded this city. He has founded it in the holy mountains. He has set it upon the hill. Go back to Genesis. All the way back to Genesis chapter 4. What we learn from some of these early histories is that it was common for people to build cities and to sometimes name them after themselves. You'll notice here in Genesis chapter 4 and verse 17, Genesis 4:17, Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Enoch. And he builded a city and called the name of the city after the name of his son, Enoch. So here's the first reference to somebody building a city, and it is, guess who? Cain, who builds this city and names it in honor of his son. Go to chapter 10 of Genesis. Chapter 10, verse 11. Out of that land went forth Asher, and builded Nineveh and the city Rehoboth and Calah. Now notice, Asher is the one who gives his name to the nation that Nineveh will be the capital of, which is Assyria. So here we have the reference to the founding of that city. Now the reason I just have you turn back there to see that we have other cases of people building cities for their honor, or in Cain's case, named it for his son. But notice that in this case, this city is the city that God has built. It's the city He founded. He's the founder of it. Cain was the founder of Enoch. God is the founder of this city, of Jerusalem. He's the one who has established it, set it on the mountains. Its foundations, then, are strong and secure. It is built on a mountain. Now, if you were to have gone to Jerusalem in the ancient days, and thinking about a city set on a mountain, you would have probably been disappointed. This is no Pikes Peak or it's no Mount Everest. The hills on which Jerusalem were built were not all that tall. There were certainly taller hills around. Mount Hermon up to the north by the Sea of Galilee was indeed, when you think of a mountain, it's a snow-covered peak most of the year round. These are just small crags, but it was impressive coming at it from every direction but the south. From the south, you sort of came down a gentle slope into Jerusalem. But from the other directions, it was surrounded by a deep gully. You had the Brook of Kidron on the east side. You had the Valley of Hinnom on the south side. And these are just very rugged cliffs, drops about 600 feet below the level of the city. So coming to Jerusalem from those directions, it would have been a very remarkable sight. And of course, Solomon's temple was one of the great wonders of the ancient world. It was a magnificent structure, for especially as early as it was and had been built. A very glorious place, a very glorious thing. And so, first of all, notice that the reference here is that the uniqueness of this city is that it's not a man-made city. It is a city that God established. He established it on the holy mountains. I want you to think back to our study in Hebrews. Would you turn over to Hebrews 11 a minute? And I want you to realize how often that theme is sounded in the book of Hebrews. And also to remind you that when we look at this from a New Testament perspective, that we are extolling the glory of a city that far transcends the earthly Jerusalem. Notice in Hebrews chapter 11, in verse 10, it speaks of Abraham wandering through the land of Canaan. And it says, "For he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God." Abraham is living his life as a pilgrim in the land of Canaan, and he is looking for a city, and it is a particular city, a city that God himself has founded. He looked for a city which had foundations. Now, when you say the foundations of a city, you speak of its stability, its permanence, its unshakability. And Abraham is looking for that city that can't be shaken. Of course, you remember the language a little later in the book of Hebrews about we're receiving this kingdom that cannot be shaken. Go down a little bit further. In verse 14 of Hebrews 11, you have them confessing they're pilgrims and strangers. And he says, "For they that say such things declare plainly that they seek a country. And truly, if they had been mindful of that country from which they came out, they might have had the opportunity to return. But now they deserve a better country, that is, a heavenly. Wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city." You get the picture? God has a city that he has prepared for those who confess in this life that they're pilgrims and strangers. Now, when we think of pilgrims, we think of the Mayflower, Plymouth Rock, people that dress funny. What is a pilgrim? Somebody just passing through. Somebody who is not permanent. Somebody is sort of like getting out here on the interstate and just watching the traffic go by. Those folks are pilgrims. They don't live here. They have no continuing city here. And so it is that God has prepared a place of permanence, a place of stability. It's a city he founded it on the Mount Zion, not this one down here, but the one up there, and he has founded it and prepared it for folks who confess they're pilgrims down here, like an Abraham, who are looking for that kind of a city. Now, that should cause your heart to leap unless you've already found you a city, unless you've already found a permanent place right here in this world. And if that's the case, then you're going to do everything you can to hold on to this life and to live right here, if this is your city. But the Christian, although he may be a citizen of an earthly city, an earthly state, an earthly country, he has a higher citizenship. Our citizenship is in heaven, Paul writes. The word there is a interesting Greek word. It refers to the very word that's in Philippians, by the way, which was a Roman province in the middle of Greece, a little Roman city in the middle of Greece. And it's the very word that they use to somebody who has a political allegiance. Our citizenship, our political allegiance is not to the Republicans, not to the Democrats. Our citizenship's in heaven. That's to whom we are primarily aligned. That's where our home is. We used to sing back home. I keep mentioning this song. We're going to sing it one of these days. This world is not my home. I'm just a passing through. My treasures are laid up somewhere beyond the blue. The angels beckon me from heaven's open door. And I can't feel at home in this world anymore. And that's the picture of the Christian. That's somebody like Abraham who confesses that he does not belong here. This place is a strange place to him, and he is a stranger to it, and he's a pilgrim just passing through. And therefore, he's not burying his treasure here. He's laying up his treasure there where his homeland is. And so, first of all, notice that the uniqueness of the city of Zion is the fact that God founded it and founded it on these foundations, and they are immovable. Then secondly, notice the fact, the uniqueness of this city is what I would call its election. By its election, I mean the fact that God has chosen it in a peculiar, special sense over all other cities. Notice how that, if you go back to Psalm 87 now, it says in verse 2 that he loved the gates of Zion, and by gates of Zion, doesn't mean he just loves the gates, he doesn't love the rest of the city. Y'all remember I was talking about what a synecdoche is? A synecdoche? Anybody familiar with that expression? Y'all were asleep that day in English grammar. Anybody remember? You remember the word? Yeah. Yes, Daryl. Head of cattle. It's where the part speaks of the whole. You speak of the whole thing by only speaking of the part. It's like I got 30 head of cattle out there in the pasture. Well, that means I don't just have 30 heads. That'd be rather strange. I've got the whole cow, but we speak of it under the whole, under the part, you see. An admiral may say, I have 1,000 sails under my command. Well, he has more than the sail. He has the whole ship, but he speaks of in that sense. Or you say, well, they were 7 souls on that plane that crashed. Well, there's more than their souls on the plane. They were bodies too, but we speak of the whole by the part. Any other expressions like that come to mind? Hands? My dad used to get up early in the morning, go pick up the hands and take them out to the field. But he took more than their hands. Well, that's what we call them. We go get the hands, put them out in the field, a whole cotton. All right? That's good illustration. Anybody else think of something like that? Well, anyway. You get the picture. A synecdoche is where you use a part of something to refer to the whole. And that's obviously what's going on here. When it says that the Lord loved the gates of Zion, it doesn't mean he just loves the gates, but it's the whole city that he loves. And notice the comparison here. He loves the gates of Zion more than all the dwellings of Jacob. All the rest of the cities in Israel, he loves this city more than he loves the rest of them. Now this begins to show that election is simply a special love of God for something. When we say that God's elect are the chosen, yeah, that's true, but they're also specially loved in a way that he does not love others. Doesn't mean he doesn't love them in any way, shape, fashion, or form, and this doesn't mean that God somehow hates the rest of the cities in Jacob, but he has a special love for Jerusalem. And so it is that God has a special love for his elect, and a special love especially shown, as I've said over and over again, in the actions of God. Now, what would God have done that would have indicated that he had a special attraction or love for this place? What made it special? Janet? Okay, we got a number of things like that. The ram was caught in the thicket up on Mount Moriah, where Jerusalem would later be built. We could say the same thing about the threshing floor of Araunah, where David offered sacrifice to turn away the angel that was about to destroy the city. But y'all are probably overlooking the obvious thing. When Christ wept over Jerusalem, we would certainly say Jesus had a particular peculiar, but I'm still fishing, huh? The temple. And what was special? What did the temple being there in Jerusalem mean? It meant God was there. This is where God chose to live. Now, when I say that, you understand that I'm not denying the omnipresence of God. It is not that somehow God is in this one spot and He's nowhere else. But what we do mean is that in Jerusalem, that's where the temple was located. And what was special about that is that this is where God makes His presence manifested. This is where God's glory is manifested, in there in the Holy of Holies, between the cherubim. If you were to ask, as we said in the wilderness wanderings, you got all these tents, and right in the middle of the camp there's a big one. And if somebody came up and said, well, who lives in that great big tent? Well, the answer is, God lives there. That's His house. When they got in Jerusalem, remember David in 2 Samuel 7 says to Nathan the prophet, well, I'm living in a house made of cedar, and God's still living in a tent. I want to build God a house. Remember that little exchange? And of course, God says, no, you're not going to build me a house. I'm going to make you a house, but it'll be your son that builds a house for my name, a house for me to live in. So that place right there in the middle of Jerusalem, what we call the temple, is actually the big house. It's God's house. This is where God has chosen to take up residence in the midst of the nations. And so, if you hold your finger here, go to Psalm 68. You may remember it's been a while, but Psalm 68 in verse 12. Verse 15. Psalm 68, verse 15, the hill of God. And remember, the hill of God is Mount Zion. The hill of God is like Bashan, a high hill, like the hill of Bashan. Why leap ye, ye high hills? This is the hill which God desires to dwell in, yea, the Lord will dwell in it forever. The idea is that there's these other hills there in Israel. Bashan was the hilly area just to the east side of the Sea of Galilee. And the idea of why leap ye, ye hills, is don't get so high and mighty hills. There may be some taller hills. Indeed, the hills of Bashan were technically taller than Mount Zion. But the point is don't get too proud. Don't get too uppity, you other hills, because this is the hill where God has chosen to dwell. This is where He has placed His residence. Now, of course, you understand that we are taught, even in the Old Testament, that God doesn't dwell in temples made with hands. This is not really, this earthly place is a replica. It's a model of where He really dwells, and that is in heaven. And so it is speaking of the heavenly residence of God Almighty in the bigger, truer sense. It is speaking of that city that we see in Revelation 21, the heavenly Jerusalem, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven. And the third thing that we can say about this city is that verse 3 of our text, glorious things are spoken of thee. It is a glorious city. It's a permanent, founded by God. It's a city that He loves, He chooses for His residence. And thirdly, it is glorious. By glorious, we mean its splendor, its radiance, its beauty, its worth. Earthly Jerusalem was indeed, because of the temple, a glorious place. The temple itself contained so much silver and gold. It's amazing that what we learned in Rome was not only after the fall of Jerusalem were about 15,000 Jewish slaves brought back to Rome to construct the Colosseum. When you look at that big Colosseum, that was built a couple of years after AD 70, and it was the slave labor that came from Israel that by and large built it. But all of a sudden, Rome's coffers were overflowing from the huge amount of silver and gold they brought back and plundered from the temple. And so Rome enriched itself out of the spoil of Jerusalem because of the just vast amounts of silver and gold that were there in the temple. This was a glorious place. And if we think of New Jerusalem, the one described in Revelation 21, coming down out of heaven as a bride adorned for her husband. Now that's pretty glorious, right? You'd think so. But the description of it is that you don't need the sun and moon in this city. The glory of the Lamb and of God lights the city. And so the splendor, the radiance, the brilliance of this place outshines all the others. And so that is its uniqueness. God founded it, God chose it, and God adorns it and glorifies it. And so now we come to the second part of this psalm, starting in verse 4 down through verse 6, that speaks of the blessings, the peculiar, unique blessings of the citizens of this city. Now, these verses, verse 4 and 5, are variously interpreted and understood, basically two schools of thought. The NIV understands this and translates it as if these cities that are mentioned here, these places, that one day these Gentile places are going to be referred to as people who were born in Zion. That's one school of thought, okay? I'm not real high on that. The King James and the ESV take another approach, and the way our text reads, it is basically saying that it is sort of man's natural tendency to be proud of the place of his birth, his home city. Do you remember Paul, one time when he's given his defense, says that he was from a particular city. Anybody know where Paul was from? Tarsus. Where was Tarsus? Cilicia. Thank you, Darren. All right. A plus. Y'all get special credit tonight. He was Saul of Tarsus. And Tarsus is in Cilicia. Okay, where's Cilicia? North Assyria, sort of south of Asia Minor. It's right there in the corner of where Turkey intersects Syria today. And so the idea is that Paul is from this place. He's not from Jerusalem. He's not from Israel. He grew up. He was a Jewish guy. His parents were Jews, but they lived in Tarsus of Cilicia. And at one point he says, I'm a Jew of Tarsus, no mean city. No mean city. What does it mean to call Tarsus no mean city? What's that? To be a mean city. Now, you understand by mean, we're not talking about mean. But when you have a group of numbers, what's the mean? The average. If you have four numbers, add them up, divide them by four, that's the mean. The median is the middle one, but the mean is the average. And so when Paul says, I came from Tarsus, no mean city, he doesn't mean it's not just your average old place. It's a special place. It's a special spot. Paul was proud of his hometown. I thought about asking tonight, are you proud of your hometown? Anybody got a word to say about where you were born and something special about it? Anybody got, okay? Go ahead, Craig. No. I'm deadly serious. Where were you born? Devil's Lake. Somehow strangely fitting. Okay. Devil's Lake, I'm assuming North Dakota? Okay, and what's special about Devil's Lake? Or would you say that's where you're from? What's your hometown? Sometimes where you're born isn't... Munich. And not the one in Germany, I'm assuming. And what's special about Munich? What's its claim to fame? No stoplights. I would say Munich is a mean city. It's just your average place. Anybody from a place that's special? Yes, Shelley. Neat place. And where is it? In Illinois. Coal miner's daughter in Illinois. Okay. Yeah, in other words, sort of a special little spot. It's not like your normal place. Okay, who else? Brag on your hometown a little bit. John? Memphis used to be. Yeah. My, how times have changed. Yeah. Yes. Okay, Sharon. Phoenix? Check your guns. Yeah, in the old days. Well, let me ask you this. Is there a sense of pride that you feel because you are from a particular place? Do you feel special? I mean, I grew up in Nevada, Texas. And about our claim to fame is Nevada was better than Josephine. Josephine was about 4 miles away, and those people were weird. And so we always prided ourselves that we were not like Josephine. You know, we were different. We are special. And Nevada always, it's a city up on a hill, little town, but it's up on top of a hill. And I always thought it was a pretty city, a little town, just because of its situation. So there's things that we're proud about where we come from and our homeland. Now, Lee Greenwood says, I'm proud to be an American. We understand this nationalistic spirit. I'm proud to be from this place, this country, this location. And there's something special about people from this place. You know, we claim some specialness because of where we're from. Well, that to me is what is being expressed here. That notice he mentions two, Rahab and Babylon in verse 4. And Rahab is a Hebrew word that means literally proud or pride, but it has about three different meanings in the Old Testament. We know, for instance, it's the name of Rahab the harlot, who was there in Jericho, and this is not talking about her. It also refers to a sea monster, a mythical sea monster that lived in the ocean. And sometimes the Hebrews referred to this sea monster as Rahab. But what it does refer to in our text is Egypt. It is a nickname for Egypt. And much like Dixie is a nickname for the South, Rahab was the nickname for the upper northern Nile area of Egypt. And so notice the first two locations that he mentions here is Egypt and Babylon. And if we are correct that this is being written roughly in Hezekiah's time, then those two places are the superpower of the day. This would be much like the Soviet Union and America back during the Cold War. These are the two big boys on the block. And obviously, if you're from one of those countries, you are proud of the fact that you're a citizen of Egypt or a citizen of Babylon. In both places, they laid claim to the fact that their civilization was very ancient. Some of the most, the oldest cities in the world. Their traditions, their learning was a cut above everybody. You know, where everybody else is out there still wandering around in ignorance and darkness. Babylon, you have the astronomy and, of course, astrologers along with that. Daniel, you remember, and all the wisdom of Babylon. You got the same thing going on in Egypt. So these were places of great learning, comparatively speaking, to the rest of the world. And you would justly be proud if you're a Babylonian or Egyptian. And then notice he mentions a few other cities around the area. Philistia, that's the land of the Philistines. Tyre was the Sidonian city on the seacoast. It was a great center of trade because it was right there on the Mediterranean Sea, a very rich place. And then Ethiopia, or Cush, was the country, black folks, that's why they're called Ethiopians, or Cushites, or the black folks that lived down in the southern Nile region. So in other words, what he's just saying is, people who come from those places are proud of their heritage, and they will say in verse 4, this man was born there. He's from there. That maybe explain why he's the way he is. He's from there. And he's proud of the fact that he's from there. I mean, you ever run into folks, I don't know how much you've gotten around, but if you get around any, you begin to realize the more you meet people that they are proud of their heritage, of their birthplace, especially nationalism. I mean, just get around the Scots a little bit, the Irish a little bit, the French. I mean, they are proud of where they're from. There's something special to them about being born where they were born. And that's what he's simply referring to, is that that's the way people are. They are proud of where they're from. But notice how that will pale in significance to verse 5. Of Zion it shall be said, this and that man were born in her. In other words, if you want to get really down to it, what really makes somebody special is that they were born in Jerusalem. That Jerusalem is your hometown. You're born there. He notice, and the highest himself shall establish her. It's one thing to be born in a man's city, a man's town. It's another thing to be born in God's town, God's city. Because God is the one who has established this place. And to be born in that place carries with it great prestige. What we would call bragging rights. You got reason to brag about the fact that you're from that place. Because this is this city that God loves more than all the other cities. This is the place where God dwells. And so in verse 6, we have this statement that the Lord shall count. The word literally means to register. The Lord will register when He writes up the people that this man was born there. God is taking a role. We have a county clerk, one of whose duties is to keep the birth records of who is born in your county. We have, when we go down to vote, we have the registrar that keeps tally of the registered voters in a place. Those people who are the citizens. In the ancient world, you had the county, they didn't call them the clerks, but you had someone who was connected to a city who kept a list of the citizens of that city. This is the roster. This is the register of those that are born here. That's why they knew when David has to go back to the place of his birth, back to the city, you know, back to Bethlehem. That's where he's from. That's where he was on the register as having been born. So he has to go back to Bethlehem to pay this tax in the days of Caesar Augustus. And so it is that you see here the same language now being applied to God Almighty, that God is keeping a register of all the folks born in His city. Now, obviously, that refers to more than just the earthly Jerusalem. Because, again, Paul will tell us that the Jerusalem above is the what of us all? Hagar answers to Jerusalem that is here, is in bondage with all her children. But Jerusalem above, who is the mother of us all, we were born to that mother, not this mother. That city, not this city. Clearly, you understand, we're not talking about physical birth, are we? In fact, in that very discussion, Paul is describing two cities who are two women, two mothers, giving birth to two different kinds of kids. Jerusalem below, giving birth to kids that are just as enslaved as she is. Jerusalem above, who's free, the mother of us all, giving birth to Isaac's miracle children. Children born of the Spirit, not of the flesh. Children that it took God to produce. And so here God is keeping a roster of those who are born in His city, or what we might call born again in His city. Born not of blood, nor of human generation, but born of God. And there is a role. There is a register. I think I would be not out of line to say that when we see the judgment day unfold, and the books, plural, are open, and the dead are judged out of those books according to their works, another book is open, the Lamb's Book of Life. And everyone not written in that book is thrown into the lake of fire. I suspect that the Lamb's Book of Life is the same register. It's the register of those who have been born again. And so notice that while humans, earthly people, may be proud and say, well, I'm from such and such, I'm from there, there is nothing to compare to the man who can say, I'm from there. I'm born in that city. That's my homeland. That's truly the place of my birth. That's my home, and that's where I'm heading. And then finally, the last verse here speaks of the unique blessings of the citizens of this city. And notice it is simply a very succinct little verse here saying the singers as well as the players on instruments shall be there. Now, if we think of musicians and singers being in a particular spot, I mean, we have earthly cities that are known for the singing and instruments. Memphis, in fact, that sort of perception of everybody out there, everybody in Memphis, you know, sings the blues or sings like Elvis Presley. Nashville, New Orleans, places like that. This is a music place, music city, we call Nashville. What the writer is saying here is that this city is a city filled with singing and music. Now, what would that indicate to you? Those folks are happy. There's a lot of rejoicing, kicking up the hills going on in that place. Now, Jerusalem below was a happy place. I keep referring to the Feast of Tabernacles, that last day of the feast, the great day of the feast, it was called, when the priest would go down to the pool of Siloam and fill up these big barrels full of water and march back to the temple courtyard and pour those barrels over the altar. And the people would be singing out of the Psalms, "With joy shall we draw forth the water of salvation." There were rabbis who said that you never knew joy until you had been in Jerusalem on the last day of the Feast of Tabernacles. This was the last day of the feast of the last feast of the year. It is celebrating the fact that God has now, the harvest has been gathered. It is rejoicing in God's blessings for His people. So yes, earthly Jerusalem had its feast days, its days of great rejoicing. But notice here we have the picture that in heaven there is this singing, the playing of instruments, the rejoicing, and notice the last statement, all my springs are in thee. My springs are in that place. And I would say that we can tell whether you're a Christian or not by getting you to figure out where your springs are. I'm not talking about springs like springs on a car. I'm talking about springs of water. Earthly Jerusalem was an interesting place in that it was unique, in that it was a city set on a hill, but it was well watered. The Gihon Spring was just outside the wall, but they managed in Hezekiah's day to dig this tunnel that brought the water from outside the wall, under the wall, into the city itself. It's an amazing feat. It went, I can't recall how long that tunnel is, and they had men digging from one end, men digging from the other, and they're about 100 feet underground. And how in the world, we still don't know to this day, how in the world they managed to meet halfway underground. But there's an inscription in that tunnel. Dan was telling, he walked it, by the way, last December when he was over there. Waded it, I should say. Said it got up to about almost waist deep at one point. But there is a place where the workers describe breaking through, that they could hear the workmen on the other side with their axes and so forth, and they finally busted through. But it, I mean, this thing, it's not even straight. It snakes around underground, but somehow they managed to meet. We still don't know how they did it. But that allowed the water from the Gihon Spring to flow into the city so that an enemy couldn't cut your water supply off. Now, that's very unusual for a city on a hill. And Jerusalem, for being up on top of a hill, was a well-watered place. You have the Pool of Siloam. You have the Pool of Bethesda. You have all these mikvah baths at the bottom of the temple steps. You had all this water. What an unusual situation to have a city on a hill that's well-watered like that. And so notice, yes, earthly Jerusalem was unique in the fact that though it was up on a hill, it still had a lot of springs. By your springs, what do you think the psalmist means? When he says, all my springs are in thee. What is your spring referring to? Joy? Life? Yeah, I would say, yeah, all of the above. Blessing, the things that make life worth living, are in this city. When we look at the heavenly Jerusalem, is it a dry place? What is flowing out from under the throne of God? The river of water of life. The tree of life growing on both sides of that river, bearing fruit for the healing of the nations. It's well watered, well supplied. Anybody remember who wrote "Glorious Things of Thee Are Spoken"? You know him. Isaac Watts. That's a great guess. Unfortunately, a wrong. But yeah, that's a good guess. Isaac Watts wrote a number of wonderful hymns. John Newton, the old slave ship captain, author of Amazing Grace. Glorious things of thee are spoken, Zion, city of our God. He whose word cannot be broken formed thee for his own abode. On the rock of ages founded, what can shake thy sure repose? With salvation's wall surrounded, thou mayest smile at all thy foes. You wonder where he got his inspiration? Right out of Psalm 87. See the streams of living waters springing from eternal love. Well supply thy sons and daughters, and all fear of want remove. Who can faint while such a river ever flows their thirst to assuage? Grace, which like the Lord the giver, never fails from age to age. Round each habitation hovering, see the cloud and fire appear, for a glory and a covering, showing that the Lord is near. Thus deriving from their banner light by night and shade by day, safe they feed upon the manna, which he gives them when they pray. Oh, yes. You want to be proud of being from somewhere, and I don't mean proud in the sense... Sometimes we use the word proud down here in the South, not in the sense of arrogance or self-sufficiency, but pleased. You know, I'm proud of my son. You mean you're pleased with your son. And the idea is, if you want to be pleased, to be from somewhere, oh, the blessing of being from that city, to be born there, to have your name on the citizenship roster of that place. Oh, what a blessed day it will be when we finally get home. Home, where we belong. We've been down here like Abraham, seeking a country. And if we could have been content down here, what he says is we would have been. We'd have been content just to stay here. But if we could never find a place, a continuing city, we have a city built of God in the heavens with foundations waiting on his people. That's the prospect that lies ahead for God's people. It's a wonderful psalm. Glorious things of thee are spoken. All right, let us go to prayer. And Newton said he gives them manna when they pray.